then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 14th, 2015. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, we'll begin this week with some more housekeeping items. Now, guys, I've said this before, but do not try to use the northwestfront.org website to send me important personal messages. I simply don't check the message section of that site as often as I should. I know that's a terrible habit, and I keep meaning to check it at least once a day, but I just keep forgetting, and before I know it, days have gone by, and I haven't gone there, and the messages are piling up. Now, my email address is nwnet, that's nwnet, at earthlink.net. Please use that rather than try to communicate with me through the website. Secondly, in a kind of reverse procedure to the above, your comments on blog posts on the northwestfront.org website, including Radio Free Northwest, should be made on the site itself in the comments section and not emailed to me privately unless there is some actual reason why you don't want to comment in public, a category which, in my view, has very narrow parameters. After every podcast, my email inbox fills up with general comments that need to be posted in public, and I'm going to start just reposting them onto the comments section where they should be. With the greatest of affection and respect, guys, you do not need to email me personally to tell you how much you like the podcast or to make some general comment about what I said. The comments section is where that belongs. Speaking of my email inbox filling up, guys, again, with the greatest of affection and highest regards, could we ease up on what Andy calls the bad news porn? The links to websites and news articles telling me how bad it's getting.
Oh, look what they're doing to us now, Harold. Isn't it so terrible?
Now, back in the day, it was a bunch of lonely old men sending each other big, huge envelopes of newspaper and magazine clippings telling each other how bad it was, and,
oh, look what they're doing to us now.
I used to get two or three of those every week, and every now and then I still get a big envelope in the mail full of newspaper clippings. And now I get emails with links to websites and news stories telling me how bad, how terrible it is, and oh, look what they're doing to us now. Look, guys, I don't need to be told how bad it is. I know. Next up, I want to thank those of you who have returned your green forms and formally joined the party. Well, kind of. You've joined the NPA. If you're not already on the organizational list, you should get your first orglets about this time next week. Okay, late last week, for some reason, I got several questions and comments from different people regarding the Northwest Constitution's ban on attorneys and the entire legal profession, and also the ban on a professional class of clergy. Now, actually, I like going over constitutional questions, and I wish I'd get more of them. I pass this on to several other comrades since the volume of questions is such that I'm developing a kind of internet politburo to help me deal with some of these long, involved, soul-outpouring letters and emails I'm getting, and I'm getting more of them. No kidding, guys, this Northwest thing really is picking up. This is a reply that a recently arrived homecoming migrant, Comrade Philip from Oregon, sent to this young man who brought up the subject of lawyers, and I'll go ahead and read that out to you, which is something I normally don't do, but this is good stuff. Oh, this kid also seemed to think that we would have a stock exchange in the Northwest Republic. Nope. And since he's in college, he as well had some very succinct comments about the existing world of what may be loosely called higher education. Anyway, here's Phil. Dear Comrade So-and-so, The main reason for eliminating lawyers in the NAR is to check the size and scope of the legal system. More lawyers mean more laws and more lawsuits, which means that now you have to hire your own lawyers to defend against other lawyers. Increased demand for legal services, thereby driving up the cost, thereby encouraging more young people to become lawyers, simply continues the cycle. Now, the Republic will certainly have a legal code beyond the Northwest Constitution, and after all, the Constitution does call for the existence of a legislature, and you don't bring such a body into existence unless you want it to legislate. But it will be much smaller and easier to understand because it was written by and for the common man. Now, I believe the novels mention the NAR legal and civil code fitting into a single medium-sized volume. There will still be contracts, for contracts are necessary for business, but you'll have to write them yourself, and the other party will be unlikely to sign an 87-page document written in American-style legalese that he can't fully understand. I would assume that you will still be able to sue somebody if a contract is breached or if you are seriously wronged in some way. Only the personal cost to you will be much higher since you will have to handle things yourself. I suspect there will be a lot of social pressure to settle things like men, and not necessarily by violence, just settling things on your own like people used to do. I haven't found very many people who genuinely like the current system who don't make a living off of it in some way. Yes, I do agree with you that college administrators are a major vector for the anti-white policies and attitudes that have been promoted over the last century. However, most of the specific individuals causing this will be dealt with before and during the time the Republic comes into existence, and I think that's vague enough to be safe. Measures will be taken to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. Without as many legal threats and without all the diversity and Title IX nonsense that crept up over the past 50 years, you won't need nearly as many admins. Without rulings like Griggs versus Duke Power, which was a case in which an ape sued Duke Power, claiming that the aptitude test Duke used as part of their hiring process was discriminatory. He won, and since then the employer switched to using a degree as a proxy for intellect. And anyway, without nonsense like that, fewer people would need a degree to get a good job. Higher education would still be available for the professions that truly require it, like medicine and engineering, but it would be greatly shrunk in terms of money, power, and influence. If leftism starts creeping back in, that's what BOSS is for. I don't have time right now to find the exact episode, but look through the RFN archives from late 2010 and early 2011. Harold touched on how higher education would be handled in the Republic and did a very good job of it, too. As for the professional clergy ban, being a man of the cloth is supposed to be something that you do out of a sense of duty to God, or the gods, or to God and the folk, whatever. Once you start bringing money into the equation, corruption starts to set in. If you work for a living, there is simply less time to get involved in things that the clergy have no business being involved in, and you retain a much greater sense of connection with your folk, since you are truly one of them, not someone who exists outside of or above normal society. As for the stock market thing, the stock market has many of the same ill effects as usury, plus the other one. It encourages, indeed mandates, high time preference. The only consideration is maximizing profits right now, resulting in things like offshoring jobs, strip mining, and other things that will kill the proverbial golden egg-laying goose. Although things will be much better for small businesses in the Republic, there is still a place for larger companies, provided that there are limits placed on their power and influence. When the muscle starts thinking it's the brain, it's time to amputate. Are you starting to see a pattern? Next to racial purity, the biggest part of establishing the Republic will be de-emphasizing the role of money in society. Money cannot be eliminated. As much as I like the barter system, I will concede that you cannot run a large, technologically sophisticated society using it. Just like government, it is a necessary evil. It must be carefully restrained to prevent it from growing large enough to consume the thing that it was meant to enhance and protect. Now, you might want to take a look at this article I read recently that touches on this very subject. In a more traditional society, social influences help to reduce the power of and the need for money. And then Phil gives a website, which I won't try to read out on the air here. Now, I read out that extensive quote from Comrade Phillips' email not only for the content, but also to demonstrate that we're getting some people up here who get it, who understand what I have been trying to say, and basically it's not just me anymore. I could have written that response myself, but I didn't. It was written by a man whom I have never met, and yet who has familiarized himself with my work and my ideas to the point where he understands it all, and he can act as a spokesman for the Northwest Republic, and I find that incredibly encouraging and uplifting. I actually have little to add to what Philip said, except to remind you folks of something that the ancient Roman statesman and philosopher Cicero once said. The existence of many laws is the sign of a corrupt society. Lawyers have never been popular down through American history for good reason. They have a well-deserved reputation for greed, dishonesty, and viciousness that goes back to the time of Shakespeare, who in one of his plays urged his characters to, quote-unquote, kill all the lawyers. In medieval peasant revolts led by men like Wat Tyler and Jack Straw and Jack Cade, the upper-class attorneys and their files of deeds and papers that kept people enslaved were always the first to go into the fire, followed by the attorneys themselves. Today, we don't kill lawyers, we elect them to high political office, and you see the result all around you. In addition to all their other negatives, by definition, they're simply not nice people. I know this is a gross oversimplification, but what they do is wicked, if you will pardon the old-fashioned terminology. No one should make a living off of human suffering, which is essentially what attorneys do. Even the most apparently harmless ones who just do wills and real estate conveyancing and such, because they are all part and parcel of a political, economic, and legal system that inflicts more untold misery on all of humanity than anything that has gone before it in the annals of mankind. The legal definition of what is a lawyer or an attorney is that he or she is, first and foremost, an officer of the court. When you retain an attorney to represent you in anything, you are not retaining counsel for yourself, primarily. He or she is not your lawyer. You always have to remember that. In the eyes of the law and in their own eyes, these people are first and foremost officers of the court, representatives of the very system that is trying to destroy you. Now, when the beast that is America comes up and wraps its scaly claws around you or a loved one, or squats like a giant toad on your life and devours your home and your family and all you have, you shouldn't have to pay over your life's savings to some stranger just to defend you from the beast. It is the beast itself that should not be, and if we had any courage, we would put an end to that beast, not pay huge sums of money to greedy and treacherous men and women just to try and make it go away and devour somebody else. I once wrote a lengthy essay called The Law is an Ass, which I think I posted a couple of times on the Thought Crime blog, and so you should be able to find it there if you use the search site feature. I may at some point in the future go so far as simply to read it out on here, although I don't like doing that. Now, anyway, in that essay, I get into the whole issue of lawyers and the court system. My main point is something that sounds like some kind of cliche, but which my bitter experience down through many years has proven to be a plain and simple fact. The entire legal system in this country is primarily a machine for generating money for lawyers and others who service that machine, such as FBI agents, for example. A lot of people I know get through life without having any contact with these things up to a certain point, but when they do, they are genuinely shocked to learn that this is the case, and horrified once they realize the kind of monstrous cash-sucking octopus they have gotten themselves entangled with. Now, we're going to have a lot of problems in the Northwest American Republic, especially during the first few years. But lawyers and professional preachers and stockbrokers will not be among them.
Greetings, comrades. This is Comrade Adam coming at you from Milwaukee, Oregon, my hometown. That's Milwaukee with an IE. So I just wanted to give you guys a rundown on my life and how I became racially aware. I had a fairly normal childhood in Bush's America. Then came middle school and my first taste with real diversity, mostly with Mexicans. And so that was not a great experience, as most of you can imagine. Or actually, no, unfortunately. Then I transferred high schools from Milwaukee to Lake Ridge, which is in Lake Oswego, which is sort of a more rich area of Portland. And there I got my first taste of the Jew. And this was during the 2012 election, so I was supporting Romney even though I had discovered the party's website and kind of listened to the first part of some RFN broadcasts, but I hadn't really accepted it yet. Then, anyway, Romney lost, and I'm like, okay, America's done for. There's no hope. And then I started dove headfirst into the party, support-wise, and started listening to RFN broadcasts over the summer very seriously, fully. And that was basically it, how I came to that. It took a little more interaction with Jews in college to actually have the Jewish question hammered home into my head and for me to find the answer, which is they're all terrible and need to be you-know-what-in. So, anyway, just want to give you guys that. Get up here in the homeland. Can't wait to see you. Bye.
This is Screwdriver.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be talking about Arthur Kemp's The Immigration Invasion. Now, I know that I promised I was going to talk about the AWB, and I'll be talking about that next week. But because immigration is such a global issue and such an urgent problem, I thought that I would talk about that first. This book is either going to be a clarion call or a memorial service. Kemp hopes that it will be former. He says that if we do not address this, who else is going to? And of course, no one else will. And he also asks whether it is best to do nothing and doing nothing is catastrophic. He says that immigration is racial because the third world is moving en masse to the first world. We can't even discuss this because it's untrendy and it's out of fashion. Now, any culture is going to reflect its population, and it's not about who's more advanced, okay? And it's not politics, morals, or economics. If there was no first world, who's going to give aid to the third world, for example? Nobody would say to the Japanese, you don't have the right to remain Japanese. For those who like to reflect on this idea of guilt regarding the Second World War, There are certainly many historians who would say that the Japanese are pretty guilty when it comes to the Second World War, and yet they don't feel any need to commit any kind of identity hara-kiri. They are perfectly fine going along remaining Japanese. So this book tackles various arguments that are made about immigration. Some say that immigration is necessary because First World tends to be aging a lot, and they say that the economies need to be rejuvenated by these younger immigrants. But of course, the immigrants themselves also age, and then they also end up costing. Now, they also say that immigrants do jobs that no one else would do, and he cites the fact that, yes, there are many unemployed whites that are willing to do various jobs. The other story is that immigration has always occurred and that there's been much more mongrelization in history than we'd like to acknowledge. They say this even about Britain nowadays, although that seems rather a stretch when you're speaking of the old world. They also, of course, say this about America and Australia, New Zealand, places of that sort. Also, there's this talk of asylum seekers and that everyone should feel badly because all these people are looking for asylum. He points out that most of these asylum seekers are really economic migrants. They flee to Europe and other places in the First World because they perceive that as better. And in a sense, of course, they are correct. If borders cannot be closed, then he asks, why were they closed so quickly after September 11th? Now, he talks about Europe and how immigrants are pouring in from all sides and how a criminal element comes in. Now, he does say that the East Bloc is a bright spot. Really, everybody there is basically some sort of native, but he fears that all these third world individuals may push east eventually. He talks about some examples of strict border control. He talks about Operation Wetback back in 1954 and how 130,000 Mexicans were deported. Talks about the Nigerians expelling 1 million that came in from Ghana back in 1983, and Pakistan also deporting Afghanis. Now, in Mexico, even a naturalized Mexican cannot hold certain jobs, can't be in government, or even the police or fire department. Countries tend to control visiting privileges. You can't even get permanent residence in Saudi Arabia. So we see over and over again that the Third World, or other countries for that matter, protect their identity, such as the Japanese. They would not reverse this situation. He talks about the elite, and he talks about the lack of will. Of course, it depends on how you define the elite, I suppose, but realistically, sometimes these elites aren't necessarily white anymore. Kemp wrote this book in 2008. And as a result, as I was reading this book, I realized that it does, for that reason, seem a bit dated, even though, of course, unfortunately, all this is still going on. He wants to formulate some answers to this crisis, and the answers that he formulates here sound very much like entryism. He speaks of a modern, normal, attractive movements. He wants us to clean up our act, in a sense, both in the States and abroad. In the States, he speaks of a Euro-American political action committee. Now, this reminds me of the various things that David Duke tried to get involved with in the past. He talks about King from the ground up. In this book, he seems to be a Ron Paul enthusiast, and he also praises the British National Party for its normalness, because he wants properly constructed political movements. Personally, I have a mixed view on this issue of normalness. I agree that appearance should be as normal as possible. But I agree that this tends to be less likely when a person feels so much out of the mainstream, because a state of mind does tend to show itself one way or another. Clearly, entryism was tried by David Duke and also by the Tea Party, but the system really withstood that. And, of course, we now know that Ron Paul did not see the White House, but now his son is running. It certainly may be that Kemp has a different outlook today. Also, two third parties have had a much better time in Europe than they have here. This book is going to spend much of its time on dire statistics. In making a summary of this book, I, of course, skipped over all of that detail. Now, just when the reader starts to feel very desperate, solutions are given that feel very moderate. Granted, I suppose in theory, a global repatriation could be launched. It would be a scale from World War II, basically. So the question is, how likely would that be? Of course, you know, it would have to be a massive geopolitical restructuring. Of course, the people most passionate about nationalist causes do tend to be, unfortunately, fairly marginal folks. Going into the mainstream and being an entry-est, if you want to call it that, requires resources, and it also requires a certain delicate expertise, which, frankly, most of us, even at our best, do not have. So I feel rather dropped by this book, because Kemp does not quite explain how to make this entryism more than, say, Pat Buchanan's unsuccessful run for office, or, again, something like the Tea Party that was absorbed and, in a sense, petered out and had a limited scope. The truth is, any solutions have to work well with the available material, and so that's just a factor of reality to consider. At any rate, this was a very sobering book. I would warn you that you may be somewhat depressed after reading this, but at any rate, it's better to face the truth. So have a good evening. Thank you so much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Minnesota. I'm on my way to Portland, Oregon with a load that came somewhere out of the off the East Coast. I got it from a driver last night in Illinois, and I know you probably are all getting sick of me talking about migration. Well, there's one easy way for you to get me to shut up. Move your ass up here, and you can take over and tell everybody how nice it is up here and why you should be up here. Until then, well, you're just gonna have to deal with it. All right, I was on the computer the other day doing a little bit of research for you, those of you that aren't up here again, or yet, excuse me. All right, U-Haul has now got into the pods thing, so you can go and rent, I think they're like 8 foot by 6 foot pods and stuff, and if you need an extra, and I think they're shipping them from, say, Miami, Florida, up to the Northwest, including your rental time to load it and your rental time to unload it, and then shipping it, I think it's like 3,000 something a box or a pod. But also was on the internet searching around and was a little off on my guesstimate on a previous little tidbit that I'd thrown in there. I saw it may vary different parts of the country, but the price I saw was about $1,500. That's $1,500 to purchase a 20-foot container, dry box, Connex box, whatever you want to call it. And then you could either have it shipped or even buy yourself an old used car trailer, strap it down on the car trailer, put it behind your vehicle, whatever it may be, pickup truck. Just don't overtax whatever you're going to be used as a tow vehicle, please. That's not a good thing. It's not easy on the equipment, and you can definitely get into some serious trouble if you're trying to stop something more than the weight-wise than the vehicle is designed to be pulling. They do put those tow limits on vehicles for a reason. It's for safety's sake. I know. I'm a friggin' redneck. I've gone and done that crap. I've had, about 2 or 3 yards in a single axle cargo trailer. It's only designed for about 2,500 pounds, and I had like 6,000 or 7,000 pounds of sand and pea gravel in it for a foundation I was laying for a hot tub years back. Yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, the thing definitely squatted down, but it was only doing it local, so it wasn't that big of a deal. I took it slow and easy, and I was only going a couple of miles with it. But yeah, on a cross-country move, yeah, try to stay within the vehicle's towing capacity. If you need a 3/4 or a 1-ton truck, get one. Hey, it works great for hauling firewood up here once you get up here, or whatever. There's vast uses for pickup trucks. And if you're a city folk, well, you probably just don't understand that, because you don't normally see the pickup trucks in the big cities. They're becoming more and more prevalent, but hey, this is about the only time I haven't had a pickup truck. Had to get rid of my last one because I couldn't get parts for it. But anyway, back to the migration. So, why aren't you up here? Oh yeah, that's right. It's wintertime and you don't want to be driving on the snow and the ice. Well, I'm going across Minnesota right now, and it's lightly snowing. There's a little bit of dust on the road. It's basically bare and dry. It's what truck says it, 3 degrees outside. It's probably a little nippy for you people down there in the southern latitudes. So, but hey, this is Minnesota. It's meant to be cold in the wintertime. Go on. Throw your meat outside and not have to worry about refrigeration. Chuck your beer in a snowbank, refrigerate it that way, make room for in the fridge. Yeah, Don't do a lot that my neck of the homeland, but eastern Washington and stuff, and Montana, yeah, you can. They definitely colder than this there. I seen the other day when I was headed eastbound on this leg, it dropped down to about 21 below, I think, over there in eastern Montana, just outside the homeland. So yeah, it gets a little nippy up here in the northern climates. So, better have some Long Johns or some antifreeze to put in your blood. Alright, well, this is the Trucker signing off for another segment. Hopefully, get to see you up there in the homeland soon. And if you show up here, you can go and shut me up by starting your own podcast and telling everybody else to get their asses up here. Alright, this is the Trucker signing off.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Trucker coming at you from my place I'm loading at. Got some time to kill here in Tempe, Arizona before I load, so I figure I'd go and shoot out a quick podcast about housing. And I know you guys are really getting tired of hearing me and Harold and everybody else talking about getting your asses and assets up here to the Northwest, and you're all going, oh God, I can't afford that. It too costs too much to move. The price of housing up there is just outrageous. Well, as long as you're not looking for a McMansion, I just got onto Zillow.com and looking in the Bremerton area here in the Pugopolis, that is a primary settlement area where I happen to reside, and a few others. There's a few mobiles or if you want to be politically correct, manufactured homes, starting at about $20,000-$25,000 for 2 and 3 bedroom ones. Yeah, they're in trailer parks, but hey, for $20,000-$25,000 and a couple hundred dollars for space rental, just about anybody can be able to cover that one and stuff. Yeah, it's one of those, yeah. I know, I've got a house, but I've had that for a number of years now, and it's paid off. But the price of fuel is down. It's wintertime, but as long as you go and time it right and keep a close eye on the weather and stuff, you should be able to avoid the storms and be able to get up here without too much problem. So I really don't want to hear any more about you can't afford housing up here when you can get into a 2 or 3 bedroom trailer, mobile home or manufactured home for, say, $20,000 to $25,000. Like I say, you should be able to swing that one unless you're one of the t-shirt youth, as Mr. Covington puts it. So a few of us truckers could probably give you at least a lift a little closer to the homeland and stuff, so you can be able to get yourself established. There are jobs up here to be had, stuff at the bottom end of the totem pole, but if you look hard enough, you can find some place to get gainful employment. All right, this is a trucker signing off for another quick tidbits from the road. Enjoy, comrades, and hope to see you up here soon, and as U-Hauls on the road headed to the northwest. This is a trucker signing off.
They say can't be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch a bandit run.
This is Charlie Daniels.
Call me a redneck, a reckon that I am, but this thing's going on, make me mad down to the core. I have to work like a dog to make ends meet. There's crooked politicians and crime in the street, and I'm madder than hell, and I ain't gonna take it no more. We tell our kids to just say no, and then some panty waist judge lets a drug dealer go. Slaps him on the wrist and it turns it back out on the town. But if I had my way with people selling dope, I'd take a big tall tree and a short piece of rope. I'd hang them up behind and let them swing till the sun goes down. Hey, you know what's wrong with the world today? People done gone, put their Bibles away. They're living by the law of the jungle, not the law of the land. Well, the good book says it, so I know it's the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You better watch where you go and remember where you've been. That's the way I see it, I'm a simple man. Now, I'm the kind of man wouldn't harm a mouse, but if I catch somebody breaking in my house, I got a 12-gauge shotgun waiting on the other side. Don't go pushing me against my will. I don't want to have to fight you, but a darn sure will. If you don't want trouble, then you better just pass me on by. As far as I'm concerned, there ain't no excuse for the raping and the killing and the child abuse. I got a way to put an end to all that mess. You just take them rascals out in the swamp. I'll put them on the knees and tie them to a stump. Let the rattlers and the bugs and the alligators do the rest. Well, you know what's wrong with the world today? People done gone, put their Bibles away. They're living by the law of the jungle, not the law of the land. Well, the good book says it, so I know it's the truth. I'm falling, I am a 2-4-2. You better watch where you go and remember where you've been. That's the way I see it, I'm a simple man. Watch where you go and remember where you've been. That's the way I see it, I'm a simple man.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Bob. I had myself muted there for a second. Had to click the right button. Anyway, Harold, I think there's more people than you know who are receptive to the idea, but they just want to be sure that it's the right time, the right place.
These are legitimate questions. I have no problem dealing with legitimate questions. I love and not deal with 20-year-old gossip from the nutty 90s, but legitimate questions are fine. And what people have to understand is that this is a solution, at least, and nobody else has one.
Yeah. Let me give out the dial-in number again. It's 310-421-4053. Anybody wants to call in, has a question or comment for Harold, you're all welcome. Again, the number is 310-421-4053. And let's talk about Fukushima for a minute, because, you know, Fukushima is a relatively recent event. It's only happened in the last couple of years. And whenever you wrote these books and conceived of this concept of the Northwest Republic, Fukushima as an ecological disaster didn't exist yet. These are black swan events you can't predict.
Yeah.
They just happen. And I don't care where you're living. If you're anywhere north of the equator, you're breathing Fukushima radiation right now. Like it or not, Everybody's got it.
Yeah. My Northwest novels are, they're not meant to be an absolute blueprint. We say we got to do it this way because this is going to happen and this is going to happen. Already, certain parts of the earlier books, the first three as I call them, have become dated. And by the time I was writing The Brigade, we all were pretty sure that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected president in 2008. I actually had a comic appearance by Barack Obama in The Brigade as General Raleigh Rollins. I won't get into it if you haven't read the book, but at that time, in the summer of 2007, when I was writing that section, Barack Obama was still kind of a figure of fun, and everyone figured it was going to be Hillary in 2008, and guess what?
It might be Hillary in 2016. We don't know, but the issues are, we have our next caller, but I just got to tell you, Harold, the books are a fun read. They're action, they're adventure, they're romance, they're intrigue, they're betrayal, it's combat, it's all kinds of cool, fun stuff. It's a great read. You don't want to put it down. They're fun books to read. Our next caller is 215. I think this is Mark.
Yes. Yeah, hello, Mike. This is Mark, and hello, Harold. I don't think I'd ever told you this, Mike, but I did have an older half-brother. His name was also Mike, and he passed away 2 years ago. Anyway, he served in Vietnam. He was in the middle of all that. And years ago, and we didn't grow up together because we had our different fathers, I'm sorry. But anyway, years ago, when I reconnected with him after my military service, like in the late 80s, I thought he was kind of negative. He grew up in a big city. He grew up in Kansas City. I grew up in southern Missouri in the countryside, and, you know, in a rural area where there was very few blacks. My older brother, half-brother and half-sister, grew up in the city in the middle of all that. So they had a different attitude because they had different experience with the minorities than I did. I was looked at them with curiosity. But anyway, so a couple of things that my brother said long ago, and I thought he was a bit negative about things. He said, Mark, he says, the rat race is over, and the rats have already won. Okay, that's one thing he said. The other thing he said was, the American people are some of the stupidest people God put on planet Earth. And what I think he was meaning were the white people.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what everybody means when they say American people, they mean white people.
Okay. So now again, Mike, I thought that he was being negative. But as I've gotten older, I'm missing him, I've grown to appreciate what he said, because there's not that that's 100%, but there's something there, because now he's about 12 years older than me and had been older than you, Mike, a little bit older than you, and a little older than Harold. So anyway, so my experience with white America, and Mike knows my history of my family, where it fell apart. My first family fell apart. My second family fell apart. And by the way, I appear to be white. my family's appeared to be white. We were white, I guess, yes. I did learn that I'm German. My culture is German from my father's side, full-blooded German. So my experience was that after my families fell apart, and by the way, I grew up in the belt buckle of the Bible Belt. So we're talking about Christians here, okay? By the way, that Hawaiians, the true native Hawaiians called Christians who landed in Hawaii, they call them Haole. You know why they call them Haole?
I was in Hawaii when I was in the Army. Haole, yeah.
They call them Haoles. And why do they call them Haoles? Because they think they're hypocrites. Because they are hypocrites. White Americans are superficial. Many, not all of them, but there's some, maybe quite a bit. I don't know. But they seem to be very superficial, very materialistic, artificial, superficial, whatever. And I don't know if that's been bred out of a lot of them, or they just bought into this artificiality and keeping up with the Joneses and being all smug and happy with their own little cliques and all that. But my experience of white America is that whenever the things went down with my family, they ran the other way. They didn't know how to deal with it. And by the way, when I got out of the service and went applying for work, Mike, there in Springfield, Missouri, where there's a lot of factories and there's work to be had there, not at that time because Reaganomics was on, but they weren't hiring, except if you were a minority. Then they would make an exception. Now, these are white people working at these establishments, white people who will turn away one of their own, even in times when they say they're not hiring, but they would have hired a minority. You know why?
Because
They're afraid to get sued. They're afraid to get sued for discrimination. Okay? So, now the other thing is, and Mike, you know this, that I'm involved with somebody who's an Asian, okay? And now every culture's got its ups and downs, because I've been with a few. But before I got involved with the other races, I was involved with white girls. And the white girls that I came across, Mike, were either, this is what I found to be. I found them to be either spoiled little daddy's girls, or they had the other extreme was they were abused by daddy. And you might find some wholesome girls, but they wanted somebody with a really strong family tree with grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles and cousins and all that. I didn't have that. So I didn't fit in with that either. So what I'm saying, Harold, is to you, is that I don't know that the white race has got it all together either. Okay? And
well, you obviously don't if you're defiling your body with a non-white.
Well, that's a little judgmental.
It sure as hell is. And as judgment okay. That every white person on the face of the earth has the right to make, what you're doing there is you're robbing the cradle of your own race of any children that you might have. I'm not going to talk to this guy anymore. If he does not understand that what he's doing is wrong, then we have nothing to say.
That's incredible.
We'll talk again another day, Mark, okay?
Thanks.
I'm sorry I didn't mean to mess up your show there, Mike, but...
No. Hey, Harry,
the man just admitted to race mixing, and we can't have the man admit to doing the one thing that's going to kill us, and I had to say something.
Harry, Harold, you've got your perspective. You're invited on as the guest. You've got priority. Mark is a caller. Is welcome to call anytime he wants and share his views. But what people don't understand and they need to understand is you and I have discussed this offline, and that is that the white race at the end of World War II was 35% of the global population. 35%. Now we're down to 8% of the global population, of which 3% is women of childbearing age. And so it's very, very important to remember these numbers. And if it's just a numbers game of breeding, the blacks, the browns, the Mexicans, the Asians, we're way behind. We're a small, small minority, and we may never get out of it. And that is, let me speak for you, Harold, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think that is the basis for your comment about why whites need to stay with whites.
Well, obviously, we're not going to get those numbers up if we breed with Asians. I've had this happen before. One of the first meetings we ever had up here in the Northwest was in an Irish pub in Bellevue, and we had a woman there who was with the Conservative Citizens Council and also with the Tea Party. This was some years ago. And I was talking about the Northwest idea to some actual Northwesters, and so we had a long, interesting meal there in a restaurant, and the guy that was sitting next to me was very interested. He was asking intelligent questions, and so I was fairly impressed with him, and he said, well, you know, I like your ideas. I think definitely that something is going to be done, and so forth and so on, but just one thing. I'm married to a Chinese woman. Is that going to be a problem? And the guy, he was asking that question in all innocence. He did not get it. He didn't get the whole thing. The purpose of what we do, everything that we do, is to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. White children, not mixed breed Eurasian children. Everything we do is because our race is facing physical genetic extinction. If you're going to do what this man is doing, I mean, why bother?
Mark's a good guy and a well-meaning guy. But you know what? This is part of the process. This is letting people know how dire the circumstance is for the white race. It is dire. But to go from 35% of the global population at the end of World War II down to 8%, you know, that's, you know, we're 25% of what we used to be percentage-wise. And now, granted, the global population has gone way up, gone from a little over a billion and a half at the end of World War II to over 7 billion now. But white people have not kept up with the breeding. Mm-hmm. Whereas the blacks and browns and Asians have been breeding prolifically, and we're just about to be capsized.
This is why we have to have our homeland. It's like the wolves were almost extinct, and now they're being slowly brought back because certain areas are being declared to be a safe habitat for them. The only safe habitat for white people is an all-white. Let me make it clear in case I haven't already, but this will be made clear on the website when you look at the Constitution, but one of the first provisions of the Constitution is that the Northwest American Republic is for only white people. There will be no blacks. There will be no Asians. There will be no Jews because they're Asians. There will be certain other classes and groups of people are constitutionally prohibited. Homosexuals, lawyers, professional paid clergy, all of the people who have caused all of the trouble in Western democracies will not be allowed there. It will be a place where white people can raise children and raise whole new generations in both physical and moral and economic safety. But the whole purpose of everything we do is for future generations of white children. And I know I've met guys like Mark and like the guy I met at the restaurant. I know there are a lot of people out there. I get people who they think a racist is someone who hates blacks. And it's so much more than that. The best definition I ever heard of that was from one of our former old leaders, the Reverend Bob Miles. Someone once asked Bob, what is a racist or who is a racist? And Bob responded, a racist is someone who knows who they are. That man that was on the phone just now clearly just does not know who he is if he could do what he's doing. That one kind of caught me by a loop, and I may have reacted a little bit strongly, but how else am I supposed to react to someone who is in the process of destroying his racist genetic heritage?
Well, the thing is, if we look at, let's look at an example like Heidi Klum. Here is a beautiful, beautiful white woman, and she went out and she had all these children by this black guy. And what does that do to her genetic heritage that she's leaving behind?
Well, it can never
be undone.
No, it can't. Basically, her children are black. The slightest touch of the tar brush, as we used to call it back in the old days, you make someone black. Might make them high yellow, might make them like Barack Obama, what we used to call back in the South, used to call them red bone, but they are not white. And in the Northwest American Republic, the constitutional prohibition is against anyone who is not a white person from one of the traditional European family of nations, which is, I believe, is what the actual wording of it is. It specifically states, though, that also in the Northwest Constitution that Jews are not white. They may have pale skins. Jews are an Asiatic people, and they are not in any way to be considered white. We have to have a land for us. One of the slogans I wish I could somehow get into Americans' heads, but it's foreign and it'll never take. The Irish had a word, Sinn Féin. Of course, it was a slogan of Irish nationalism, but basically it means ourselves alone. I've often wanted, if we ever get the party going, I might run this up the flagpole again and see if anybody salutes, but to make the English version of that kind of a party slogan, maybe put it on our seals or our literature, ourselves alone. Another mantra of ours is, if white people had a country of their own, this wouldn't be happening. And, of course, everybody who hears this knows what this is because everybody has their own version of this.
Let me ask you this question. Why is the Khazarian Mafia, and why are so many vested interests so afraid of allowing a white country to exist? An all-white country?
Because they know that every white person would want to go there, want to live there. And they know that if we were allowed to live in peace and raise a couple of more generations of white people in peace, we eventually would break out of our little reservation or our Bantustan or our country, and we would take the whole world back. We would recover our strength, and we would eventually come after them and put them down and take back what is rightfully ours, which is the entire world. And that can't be done until we basically get a breather, until we are able to raise a few generations of white children and get our numbers back up and get them raised, as I said, in spiritual and mental health.
Because the social hygiene of the society we live in now, with the heavy Talmudic influence in it, is really, it's toxic. It's toxic for good mental health. It's toxic for every people, blacks, whites, brown, Asians.
You know, it strikes me we haven't had a Jesse James song on here for a while. So this is Levon Helm from one of the Outlaws albums from the early 1980s, I believe. It's a story of how young Jesse James learned a very valuable lesson in life. Never trust the word of a federal agent or any official of the government of the United States.
Have you heard the news, boy?
Don't give us the news.
This war's done finished. He has surrendered and all the officers amnesty. They say if we report to the government office, take their oath, we can go home free.
Tell us some more.
But Jesse gone down to the Union outpost, surrendered his guns to the major in town. Pulled off free with his federal papers, cavalry ambush, cut him down.
Just filled the trail.
Well, he bled like a pig and trawled through the bushes. Oh. So his marshal left him for dead. Oh. Arch Clemens found him lying in the middle. Oh. Carried him back to the old homestead.
Well, where is he now?
Here's some more, boy.
You wanna hear some more?
Well, I took him to Kansas to the home of an uncle. The veteran's cousin is caring for him. He's the prettiest thing this side of Kentucky. He's put it hard in the spin.
Well, I'll be darned.
Have you heard the news, boy?
We've heard the news.
Well, here we are, out of time again. Lord, I missed that extra 8 to 12 minutes I was able to tack on at the end before we started getting syndicated and had to keep these shows down to an hour, more or less. But I do have a couple of minutes left to address one particular question that pops up every now and then in some form or another, and which popped up last week. Basically, it runs something like this. When, Harold? When? When will it happen? Of course, most people, when they ask this question, want me to set some kind of definite date or at least a year, and I can't do that. I refuse to become like one of these doomsday preachers who tells his followers that the world is going to end at 10 o'clock p.m. on June the 23rd, 2015, and they sell off everything they own, all their worldly goods, and the preacher gathers them all up on a mountain top down in Pissant, Georgia someplace, to await the return of the great jumping Jesus. And then when the clock strikes 10:01 and no end of the world, he looks mighty foolish. It is absolutely impossible to know when this horrible world created by political correctness is going to end. But I think it's pretty obvious by now to anyone with two brain cells to rub together, never mind any knowledge of human history, that it will end, almost certainly within the lifetimes of the majority of people now living. The signs are all there, and no, I don't mean signs from the Bible in the form of obscure verses from the book of Revelation. You know, it's odd how people will accept that kind of thing as firm evidence of the coming end of time, and yet they'll simply ignore the very real, very human, and hardcore factual evidence of an impending implosion all around them, and still insist that this toilet we're living in now will last forever, like so many Francis Fukuyamas jabbering about the end of history. I can, however, make some predictions. Now, the whole ball of wax will come crashing down around the dictatorship's ears, if you'll pardon the mixed metaphor, when certain conditions pertain in this country. When certain red lines are crossed having to do with that revolutionary tripod Mike Harris and I were talking about a few weeks ago. Now, this is a fascinating subject, and I'll get more into it in later shows, but very loosely, the balloon will go up when the following conditions obtain. Number one, when the American dictatorship suffers a major military defeat somewhere in the world, be it a stupid war with Iran or Russia or ISIS or President Hillary Clinton invades Canada, whatever. Now, something along the line of a Middle East Custer's last stand that shatters forever the myth of American military invincibility and somehow involves breaking or otherwise neutralizing American air power, which is still, well, I won't say the queen of the battlefield, but let's say the sleazy 50-year-old stripper of the battlefield on her last legs and ready to make way for something new. Now bear in mind, one of the reasons the air arm is switching like mad to drones is because they can't get a sufficient number of competent pilots anymore, thanks to political correctness and the dumbing down of young white boys. Number two, there must be one or both of two economic catastrophes, a major disruption in the foreign oil supply, most likely due to some kind of lunatic assault on Iran by Israel or the U.S., or else there has to be a prolonged breakdown of the EBT system in this country, either through a massive computer glitch or else through the collapse of the money system, either through just plain running out of money or else everybody suddenly realizes that the Federal Reserve notes aren't actually real money. And they become worthless. Preferably both at once. $18 per gallon gasoline and nobody has any money to buy it with. Number three, through a complex combination of factors, some of which we can guess at today and some of which we can have no way of predicting, there must be a sufficient release of the downward pressure from the iron heel so that we can breathe a bit and so that some semblance of free speech is inadvertently restored. And ordinary white people can once again speak their minds in the workplace and in public without being punished in the various ways that this system punishes dissent. When I or someone like me can speak freely, much more freely than I can now, and speak out loud of the true solution to the crisis which threatens us without fear of arrest, because for whatever reason the secret police have gone off duty because they haven't been paid, or else they're just too occupied elsewhere. Now, there are a number of ways in which that could come about, and if I can remember next week, I'll get further into this. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their fate. Oh.